Can I raise these mics?
Who is your Abigail?
I'm going to ask you that question at the end.
Who was Abigail?
Now, many of you probably thought and remembered about Abigail. She's mentioned in 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, quite a bit, actually, as one of those women who is mentioned in the Old Testament. Let me tell you the story. You can follow along with those scriptures, 1 Samuel 25, 27, 30, 2 Samuel 2, 3, 1 Chronicles 3. Abigail was a woman that was first married to a man named Nabal. And he had a great reputation. He was a drunkard. But he owned large herds, and he owned a lot of land. And in those days, you know, that was the sign of wealth. And what is wealth classically? Today we think of it as money. But in those days, it was really herds, property. If we read that story about Nabal, David is fleeing in the wilderness during the time before he is anointed the final time as king. And he's fleeing Saul. We'll talk a little bit about that story. But he's fleeing Saul in the wilderness for 7 years. And David is looking with a whole host of people. He encounters Nabal. Nabal insults him. David gets very mad at him. And David is ready to kill him. And Abigail, who's the wife of Nabal, comes in as a mediator. She comes as a mediator to appease David. And Nabal dies suddenly, and Abigail becomes David's wife and bears him a son named Chileab. That's the story of Abigail. So we have four characters that I want to discuss in this: Nabal, David, Saul, and finally Abigail. Let's talk a little bit about Saul first. Remember, Saul is made king at Gilgal at age 40. Israel said, look, we're tired of this theocracy. You're not good enough, God. We want a king. It was actually not precisely what they said, but remember, they had the judges that God gave them to deliver them. They finally said, you know, we don't want to be, like Rick talked about, you know, we respect the land, but we don't want to be indifferent to anybody else. We want a king. So Samuel is instructed by God to go and get Saul as a king. Samuel 15, 1-3, we read, Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now, therefore, listen to the words of the Lord." It's too bad that Saul didn't heed the first thing he hears from Samuel. Listen to the words of the Lord. And Saul, when he started out, every reason to think he had that humility that was necessary. And even though David was God's first choice, he was going to wait for a while. But Saul was given the opportunity. But that was his problem, is he didn't listen to the words of the Lord. Because what were those words? In the third verse, God says, I'm going to pay back the Amalekites for all the stuff that they did to Israel. And he set them up when they were coming from Egypt. They wouldn't let them pass through. They were attacking them, and they were really striking them. So the first thing he orders Saul to do, he says, now, you go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has. Do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. The Amalekites were to be wiped out. One of the reasons, I'm not going to get into all the reasons behind God's commands to kill as he did, but remember, he's trying to preserve Israel for a very important purpose, not only to bring the Messiah, but to be his chosen nation. And be a light to the Gentiles. So that was the instruction to Saul. But Saul, of course, disobeyed. Saul did defeat the Amalekites. He did do that, but rather than all the things that he was supposed to do, he captures Agag, who was that king, and took him, destroyed everything else and all the people, but he kept Agag alive, and he didn't kill all the animals. He kept the best of the sheep, it says, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and was not willing to destroy them utterly. Disobeyed, and that was a grievous thing on God's part. That Saul, in an opportunity to solidify himself as God's first chosen king, he rejected God in that command. So God rejects Saul. Verse 10, we read, "The word of the Lord came to Samuel saying, 'I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned his back from following me and has not carried out my commands.'" Saul had an opportunity, God said, to have his generations on the throne, but because Saul disobeyed, God rejected him. And Samuel had to give him the bad news. Samuel, in that verse 22, says, after this rationale that Saul has for doing what he did and saying he's going to sacrifice these things, that's why he kept it. He wanted to sacrifice to God. And he thought God would be pleased with that. Samuel said, "Has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord?" Brethren, here's one of the most famous verses that we quote, isn't it, amongst Bible students? "Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams." God was not a God like other supposed gods that you had to sacrifice to. God was after one thing, as we just heard. He was after obedience. Those commandments were about obeying him for the good of all. It was not because he was a God that was selfish, but it was a God that would share his wealth with all of them. So for him to obey him, simply what he asked Adam too, to obey him was better than to sacrifice to him. Well, what was Saul's reaction? You always heard that saying, don't shoot the messenger, right? Unfortunately, Saul tried to shoot the messenger. As Samuel turned to go, Saul seized the edge of his robe and it tore. And Samuel, being a quick-witted prophet, used that analogy in an analogy to say, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor." Here's the cutting remark, "who is better than you." Not as a person, although David was, but he knew that David was going to obey him, most part. That's really what he was asking for Saul. And now he knew David was going to do that. So God chooses David instead of Saul from the tribe of Judah. And we know that David was really chosen earlier to be there. It was always intended that the king come from that line of Judah, because that would be the line from which Jesus could claim the throne. But David had to wait, and there are many reasons. We won't talk about them now, but there are many reasons why I think God waited for David. Among those, some of the past sins of Israel. But to get to that point where he could show them, Israel, that it was his choice that was important. We read about David coming to the throne here in 1 Samuel 16:12. It says, "So he sent him in." This was his child. He had gone to Jesse, remember, and asked for his son, all his sons, and Jesse brought him in. And it says he was ruddy, with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. Now, anybody in the audience that thinks they look like David, would you stand up? Yes. I have an ongoing debate with Sister Ruth Eldridge, who incidentally helped me with this study, about what David looked like. And so we have this constant debate about, you know, what this word ruddy and handsome means in terms of what people look like in those days. So, But the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." God was choosing David at this point. And he says, "The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward." David was elevated. Now let me step aside for a moment, because David already had a battle reputation when he was called in to soothe Saul after Saul was rejected by Samuel. When we read the account, it appears as though David is called in to play his harp and soothe Saul, and that Saul meets him for the first time. I want to just briefly cover that because I think it's an important part of the story. And I'm just going to highlight one part when David is called in to soothe Saul playing his harp. It says, "David was a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior." Now, when you see the movies about David coming in here, you see this little kid coming in with a harp. That's not the warrior and the mighty man of valor. We have an indication here that David already has this reputation. David has a strong reputation within Israel, and I think even with Saul at this point. We can determine that by seeing that in our common version, David was the armor bearer to Saul when he killed Goliath. He was introduced to Saul at some point, and I think 1 Samuel 17, where we have it here, is misplaced. The Alexandrian manuscript, and if you read the Septuagint version, which is available to us, the Septuagint version, if you look at that, you will see a skip from verse 11 of chapter 17 right to verse 32. It jumps from verse 11 to 32 because of that Septuagint manuscript. And I know some of you have it on your computer. You can check it now. Septuagint also omits another passage. It omits chapter 17, verse 55 to chapter 18, verse 4. Those are the ones that kind of mix this story of David. So the Vatican manuscript, which is used in our common versions, is it really may have inserted this whole section, 11 to 32, 55 to 58, and 18, 1 to 4. Now, without going into great detail, let me show you what happens with the Septuagint, where it omits verses 12 to 31 and provides a harmony in this story of David and Saul. Verse 1 of chapter 17 says, "When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine," this was when Goliath was challenging them, "they were dismayed and greatly afraid." And then it skips right to what we have in verse 32. "David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine.' Then Saul said to David, 'You are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth.'" Now notice, David is already the armor bearer to Saul. So they have already met. And then the Septuagint omits, as I said, 1755 to 18:1-4. So after David killed Goliath, he takes the Philistine's head and brings it to Jerusalem, and he puts his weapons in the tent. And then it skips right to verse 5. It says, "So David went out everywhere Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul sent him over the men of war, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants." So David had this encounter with Saul, and he was greatly respected prior to the time he really came in there to play that harp in the way that it mostly seems to be. David's popularity, however, is the problem. David's popularity makes Saul think, "Now, Samuel told me that my neighbor is going to take my place. Okay, I know about David. Is he the one?" Because it says when David returned from killing the Philistine, the women came out of the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet Saul with musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, "Saul has slain his thousands. David his 10,000. His popularity is great." Then Saul became very angry. They have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me, they have ascribed thousands. And here's his key statement. Now, what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. That's the story of how Saul gets this antagonistic attitude towards David. And it's why David has to flee from Saul. And David flees into that Judean hillside east of Jerusalem. Those of you who have been to Israel know where that is, those hillsides where David hid. And verse 18 says, David fled and escaped and came to Samuel, who had anointed him earlier, and told him everything that Saul had done. And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth. So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam in this area. Of course, that cave of Adullam is a great picture. It was used by David for 7 years as his base. I think this particular part of the story of David is a beautiful picture of David and the church. First suggested by Brother Hudson, who writes the Bible Study Monthly. If you read that article, he has an article called The Cave of Adullam. And I think he presents a very good story how this was a picture of the church. David was prepared for office in his 7 years while he was there. Samuel calls it the strongholds of Engedi. And it says David attracted many followers there. And if you're reading in this 1 Samuel, it's really a precious one. It says all those who were oppressed, all those who were poor, all those who were downtrodden came to David. Isn't that the picture of how the church comes to Jesus? 7 years, of course, is a magic number. I don't want to say magic. A significant number from Scripture of the period of the complete church. David attracted his followers there, and those experiences really prepared David to be king, just as the experiences of the church during this time prepares them to be a joint king. David became acquainted with the lifestyle of the people. He wrote many of the Psalms that acquainted him with God, and a most beautiful picture there of our experiences dwelling with Jesus in the wilderness while we're being prepared for the next stage. But that's a secondary story. We come now to the heart of the story. We come to Nabal and Abigail. 1 Samuel 25:2. This is a story while David's in this period, 7 year period of the wilderness. A man in Maon who had property at Carmel, we said he was very wealthy. 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats, and he was shearing sheep. Okay, had to do that every year. His name was Nabal. His wife's name was Abigail. So she was an intelligent and beautiful woman. Now I'm going to ask the sisters, if any of you feel like you would be like Abigail, stand up. Well, again, you get the picture. It's a beautiful story here we're weaving with David and Abigail. She was a Calebite and was surly. Now, I know what I like to think surly. My wife at times gets surly. But it really doesn't mean that. It means Nabal was a base fellow. Okay, we think of surly as getting a little angry, but it means he really gave in to his lower elements. And he was mean in his dealings. You wonder how a beautiful woman like Abigail gets married to him, but remember, these were the days of pretty much arranged marriages. David hears of this, and of course, David, by this time, he's got a lot of men. He's got a lot of men and women. We know he had probably close to 1,000 at this point that were following him. David hears of Nabal living in this area. And the Septuagint says again, Maon instead of Paran. And the sheep shearing business always, you know, those of you that have been in farming know when you're bringing your harvest in, you have to hire workers come and work on the farm. It's no different than sheep shearing. They had to have extra hands. And so David says, I've got 600 men. I've got women and children with them. I've got to get provisions for them. So he says, I always following the work. They share everything, and then we have a big feast. And so David says, I'm going to send my men there to protect the workers from thieves who would enter in and steal the sheep when they had them all gathered in. It's like cattle rustling when you get them rounded up. Going to protect them and save them from marauders that would come by. And we read in verse 4 there, while David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep, and he sent the men, told them, you know, go up here, greet him in my name and say, you know, we're from David. He wishes you long life, good health to you and your household, good health to all that is yours. We hear that it's sheep shearing time, David says. When your shepherds were with us, you know, we didn't mistreat them. We were 600 men. The whole time, there was nothing missing. We protected them from everything. You know, ask your servants. They'll tell you how good we were. So David is asking you, please be favorable towards our people. We come at a festive time and we could use provisions. Whatever you can give to them, that would be great. He's asking for him to just be neighborly. You know, there, incidentally, Handel wrote a concert called Nabal. Interesting that he would pick him out, but it's interesting music if you get a chance to listen to it. What happens when David's men get there and Nabal, they give this message to Nabal? He says, oh yeah, come on in. I'm so grateful. Here, take half of what I've got. No. What's his reaction? Who's David? Who is this son of Jesse? You know, there's a lot of servants that are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I give David anything? Why should I give him my bread and water? I don't know these guys. Maybe they did. Maybe they could have hurt me. You know, I've done all the slaughtering. Why should I give it to them? So David's men get sent back. They take this message back to David, and they says they reported every word. This is my picture of David. Okay. Ruth doesn't like that one. I don't know. This is from a movie, and I'm not sure David looked like this, but to me, this is not ready. Anyways, David says to his men, okay, put on your swords. We are going to teach Nabal a lesson about who we are. So David takes 400 men, 200 stay with the supplies, and he says, you know, I was good to this guy. What did he do to me? He returns evil for good. So may God deal with David, be it ever severely, if I don't go there in the morning and kill every male that's on his place. That'll show him. And if you know, King James has an idiom there. He says, I'm going to take out everyone. Unlike David. And here we have Abigail entering the story. Nabal's shepherds are very fearful. They know they had to turn back these guys, and they know that these guys are warriors. And so they go to Abigail and say, here's a bad situation. Abigail goes out to meet David. And if you can see her, she bows before David. She goes to meet David. When she sees him, she gets off her donkey. She bows down, puts her face to the ground. She says, David, let the blame be on me alone. Please let me speak to you. Hear what I have to say. Don't pay any attention to this guy. He's a wicked man. He's not at your level. He's nothing. He was described as surly. He's just like his name, which means a fool. And folly goes with him. Forgive his offense. The Lord will make you remember. She knew what David was bound for. The Lord will make you a king because you fight the Lord's battles. Don't do this. You know, let no wrongdoing be found in you. Don't take out your personal vengeance on this man. Even though someone else, Saul, is pursuing your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. Example, the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. So he tells him, David, you know, you are going to be the king. We know that. We know that you have not damaged Saul. don't take out your personal vengeance on this man that means absolutely nothing because he upset you. So she says, when the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised and appointed him, in other words, she's talking to David, leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience. David, you won't have on your conscience this needless bloodshed if you kill everybody to avenge yourself and say, take that. What did David do? Verse 32, he said to Abigail, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. David understood that message. Abigail's words redirected David's anger. God used Abigail to save David from a gross sin. Now later, David would have his other problems. But here, now David, in this whole 7 years, he had never killed to avenge a personal affront, had escaped from killing Saul several times. But here he was ready to wipe out this guy because of a personal insult. Abigail stopped him from rendering evil for evil. Reminded of that scripture in Deuteronomy 32:35, to me belongeth vengeance and recompense. Well, God took care of it. Abigail went back to Nabal. He was in the house. He held a banquet. And of course, as said, he was a drunk. He got high spirits. He got drunk. And then she didn't tell him anything about this situation. It says, in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things that had gone through. He was so scared that David was going to come to him. It says, his heart failed him and he became like a stone. He had a heart attack from that, and he froze and probably became, what's the word I'm looking for? Paralyzed. Thank you. And 10 days later, Nabal dies. David heard that he was dead. He came to Abigail and says, you know, he kept his servant from doing wrong. God did work through her. Kept his servant from doing wrong, and he brought that vengeance for us. David then sent word to Abigail, asking or spoke out to her to become his wife. And the servants went there, said to Abigail, David has sent us to you to become his wife. Isn't that a great story? What a beautiful story. But that's not all of it. Why is there such a detailed account of this in Scripture? Most of David's wives, he had eight of them, many were unnamed, and most of them were virtually unknown. Bathsheba is probably the only other famous one that's mentioned, but I think there's a great lesson that's preserved in this situation with Abigail, and that begs us the question that I started out with. In times of crisis, times of indignation, we get angry, just like David. Or we may fall to the temptations of the flesh to do something that would go contrary to the Lord's will, whether it's speaking out or taking an action that we know we shouldn't take against a brother, a sister, or someone else because we don't know how to cope. Our personal passions, the flesh rises inside of us. And something happens to change that. We have an Abigail experience. Saul loved David, but he was overcome with pride and jealousy. And he sought to kill him. David was hunted. He was hiding. He was weary. He was hungry. 7 years he's fleeing in the wilderness, just trying to get food for everyone that's following. But all that time he stood firm in God's spirit. And he refused to take vengeance on Saul, even when he had an opportunity. But he was put off guard. He was put off guard by this meaningless insult from someone that he shouldn't have even been affected by. Brethren, that can happen to us. How does God prepare us for our priesthood? Matthew 26:41, Jesus said to the disciples, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. You know, big trials, brethren, mold our character. And we can endure them when we have a significant, huge trial because the Spirit helps us. But you know those everyday indignities, the insults, the injustices that we suffer every day, those are tough. We want to react and say, you know, take that. You cut me off, I'll cut you off. You know, I remember a sister telling us one time that she got caught away and made an obscene gesture to someone that had cut her off, and she felt so bad about it. But you know, that can happen, brethren. That's the weakness of our flesh. God gives us an Abigail or an Abigail experience to keep us from doing that. It may be something that obstructs our way. It may be a person that comes our way. Keep us from defending what is nothing more than our pride. So my question to you, brethren, who has been or who will be your Abigail? Watch for them. Recognize that it may be the Lord redirecting your personal offense to a different way. Proverbs 25:11 says, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pictures of silver. Proverbs 25:12 says, as an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon an obedient ear. Brethren, let us be obedient to God. Let us always be attuned to those words coming at us, those words fitly spoken that keep us from making the mistakes that will cost us our purpose and bring us regrets. Let us recognize and be thankful for our Abigails and listen and thank them.